So we're here at the beautiful Sokal Seva Ashram. We're at the Pushpa Samadhi of our Gurudev, Srila Bhakti Sundar Govindadev Goswami Maharaj. And I'm sitting with Hriday Govinda Prabhu. And I've known Hriday Govinda for some years now. I don't remember exactly, 4 or 5 years.
Three, four maybe.
Something like that. And I first met him at our Salt Lake City temple. And I've always been impressed by his serving mood. He was living there, serving full time, helping with the cooking. He's a wonderful cook. He's also a wonderful gardener. He also was helping with the puja seva. And I've just always been very attracted by his amiable and happy service mood and his friendly nature, and gets along well with everybody. He's a disciple of Srila Janarda Maharaj, and naturally he was drawn to come to be closer to his Gurudev. And so now he's serving here at the Sokal Seva Ashram, helping with whatever is necessary. Puja, cooking, cleaning, you know, gardening, construction, and all kinds of service. So, Hriday Govinda, maybe you can share something with us of your story, how you came to Krishna consciousness.
Okay. Real fast, I'll say that it's easy to be in this pleasant and awesome mood when you're around the devotees. So maybe if you had met me out in the world, I wouldn't be so pleasant and handy at so many tasks. But the devotees got a hold of me and turned me into a useful tool for the Lord's service. So many devotees may be some familiar with my story of how I came to Krishna consciousness, and I can share a summarized version. And so when I was in second grade school, very young, my parents and family had decided that they wanted to make me Catholic like they were. And it just wasn't for me. From a very young age, I felt like I was an atheist. I didn't think anything there was a God, or if he was real and he was the God that these people were talking about, I didn't really want anything to do with him. I don't know why. I'm a contrarian. I'm anti. And I'm difficult. And so either way, I just completely rejected all religion. And then by sixth grade, I was kind of like an agnostic. I was kind of like, I don't know. There's probably something governing all this randomness. But I haven't found any, you know, group of people in their set of rules and laws and books that, you know, I think really sums it up. Or, and then I met Nisringa. So I met Nisringa Chaitanya, which I'm sure he's quite famous, Mott-wide. I met Nisringa Chaitanya. I was about 14. Maybe he was like 13. And if anybody's familiar with early 90s American culture, it was the first day of middle school, and I was wearing some Tenai Doc Martens and some cut-off camouflage shorts and a Rage Against the Machine t-shirt, probably greasy, disheveled hair. And it was the first day of school. You know, you don't know your way around yet. And they give you a schedule. I just crumpled it up and stuck it in my pocket, and I show up to art class kind of late. And I pull out this crumpled thing from my pocket, and I said, I don't know, is this where I'm supposed to be? And I remember the lady, Miss Bennett, and she said, yes, your seat's right over there. And so I sat down, and literally maybe 45 seconds later, here comes Nisringa Chaitanya with matted hair, JNCO jeans, busted Converse, Rage Against the Machine shirt. And he pulls a crumpled remnants of a schedule out of his pocket and asks the teacher, is this where I'm supposed to be? And so she says, yes, and your seat is right there. And so I'm guessing she did the seating chart alphabetically because he was right next to me. So all we did, it took us all of 30 seconds to realize that obviously this guy knows something about life. And it was pretty much instantly friends. And then sometime at this point in the Nisringa Chaitanya's life, he was leaning toward American teenage culture. I like to call this Nisringa's Rumspringa period. It's a Dutch word. The Amish use it when they're teenagers. When the Amish are teenagers, they're allowed to drive cars and use the internet. And that way their faith is genuine when they come back, because if you never let them do it, then they would be always be wondering, you know, and it may be some source of them falling down later in life. So they kind of let them be teenagers and see the world and see why they want to leave it. And if, you know, anyway, I think Nisringa was in that time because he grew up in Saffron and Shaved Head and Gurukul, and he just wanted to, you know, eat junk food and play video games and listen to hip hop music and be a kid for a little while. And I guess to a lot of devotee parents, I think I represented just that. So the whole reason they kept their kids in Gurukul was to be away from kids like me. But yeah, there I was. So I was obviously not always the most popular amongst the devotee parents. But when I first saw at his mom's house, the altar set up, you know, there's mrdangas and kartels and guru paramparas there and maybe some lights and the paintings, obviously, we've all seen the Krishna art book and Chaitanya Charitamrita, and we're all familiar with the detailed and very beautiful painting associated with this faith and philosophy. And so I'm seeing all these things, and from my, you know, very plain kind of meat and potatoes Catholic background, I'm seeing the wonderful, you know, colors of this altar. And I was just instantly very curious, you know, this is completely different than anything I've ever been brought up with. I knew I was in the mode of rejecting, you know, materialism, consumerism, general Western life. I really wasn't about it. I didn't want to, you know, like have kids and a job and all this like stuff that everybody was shooting for. I just didn't really know what to replace it with. And so from that age on, around 15, I was pretty regularly attending at least something at the Baltimore Temple. And myself and Nisringa went to a festival. He kind of had a revelation, and he decided at around age 18 that he was going to go back. And he was done with, you know, American teenage ways, and he realized his parents were onto something, and I'm going to go back to Krishna consciousness. I accompanied him to Prabhupada Village in North Carolina, and I stayed with him there for about 3 weeks. And toward the end of it, I was kind of like, maybe Nisringa's come out of this. You know, maybe we're going to go back on the road now. And because I always had a very affectionate for all the devotees. And, you know, all the Hare Krishnas I met, I always loved them. I loved prasadam, I loved the music, but I wasn't like ready to shave up, and I wasn't ready to commit to anything. I had another 15 years of acquiring, controlling, and consuming ahead of me. Whereas Nisringa started developing, cultivating bhakti lata bij, spiritual life. And so I continued on my path of acquiring, controlling, and consuming, and it led me to very extreme and low places. It led me to Hawaii, and it led me many places. And I'll keep all the details vague and brief, but, you know, just completely degraded, you know, drug and alcohol problems very severely. And I, as a stubborn person, I've always been extremely stubborn, and somebody will say that fire is hot. Well, I don't believe you until I've stuck my foot in it. And that's just the way I operate, to my better or worse. But I have to learn these things for myself. So, you know, in DARE class, they sit there and they sit you down and they say, don't do this X, Y, and Z drugs. I'm basically taking down a list of what to try next.
Which class?
DARE class. Is where a cop would come into your school at a young age and kind of tell you all about all these drugs that you knew nothing about. He'd tell you all about them and why they're bad. So if anything, he just kind of educated you to their presence. But anyway, I wasn't satiated with what everybody else was satiated with. They were satiated with their school and finding their job and everything else, and it wasn't doing anything for me. From a very young age, they could write a B, an X, a Y on the paper. And if they wrote an A, I had to do a lot of work. If they wrote an E, I didn't have to do work. And I really didn't care what letter they wrote on the paper. So I was obviously hankering for something, but I didn't really know what. And 15 years went by. And my body was a mess. My mind was worse. I wasn't worth anything to anybody. Not even myself. And I think the only reason I even survived that really low period of life Without the devotee, it's Brownie. You know, I had to get up and...
Brownie is...
My dog. And if I didn't have to get up and feed her and take care of her, and if I didn't have that love for another being, I certainly didn't have any for myself or care really about anything. And so she kind of at least got me to get up and find some food for her. So I had to at least do that. But everything just got so horrible. I was going to be homeless on the street with Brownie, and my family had pretty much completely given up on me altogether. But I knew I was in a rehab. I was at Father Martin's Ashley Rehab in Maryland. And I knew what I had to do because I'd been through so many addictions and so many things before. And they wanted me to do this counseling thing and this halfway house and all this stuff. And I said, I'm not doing all this again. I know what I have to do. I have to get in touch with the devotees, wherever they are. I was about to just go to the Baltimore Temple. That was the only thing I knew, you know, and just, you know, give me some service, something. I was really desperate. And I told my counselor there, I said, I know what I have to do. I said, I have to find the Hare Krishnas. I didn't know anything about, you know, NM or ISKCON or SCS or anything. You know, I just knew there was the happy devotee people with the Murdungas and the Prashadam. And they always had a job for me to do. And if I didn't find them, I knew I wasn't gonna do anything with myself. So my drug counselor, he tells me, you can't just run away and join the Hare Krishnas. Your addiction will follow you. And so, you know, being contrarian and rebellious, it's just, you know, I'll show this guy. And so I think I remember about 2 years after I was at the Salt Lake Temple, I emailed him with a very respectful yet told you so email about how I was still sober and it was all due to the mercy of the devotees. But so I got in touch with Nisringa, and I was, you know, inches away from being homeless on the street of Maryland, just completely drug dependent and wasted life, body, mind, everything. And I reached out to Nisringa's brother, actually, Nithai. I reached out to him because he was on the Facebook. And Nisringa was not. And so I got a hold of Nisringa's phone number, and he was living at the Salt Lake Temple. And he, you know, kind of, he vouched for me. He went out on the line, you know, because it's a lot of years, and he might not have known exactly who he was inviting back. He visited with me in Maryland, and we had some long talks and everything, but he put himself out there to give me the chance to come. And I didn't know, you know, how anything was going to turn out or be, but I knew it was what I had to do, and I knew I didn't have any other choice in my life. And so I showed up to Salt Lake, and the rest is history. I showed up without Brownie and was able to go back and get her. But that was my very crooked, you know, not straight and zigzaggy way of showing up here.
You went from a life of, you know, drugs and suffering straight to the temple, and you just made that transition like overnight. Is that what happened?
Well, I had to about a week before I arrived at the temple, I had to physically detox myself. So, you know, it's a very caring and forgiving place, but it's not a hospital. And so you can't just show up to the temple, you know, all sick and detoxing. Sometimes, you know, you need doctors to help you. So I was able to detox myself. And after doing that, I had maybe like 3 days or 4 days of actual, like, clean and not kicking time. So that means I probably had like 9 days of sobriety, and I think I smoked my last cigarette like as Nisringa was pulling up. It's like throwing it, you know. I you know, may have had a stumble or two along the way, but nothing compared to my past ways, you know.
And what about your faith in Krishna consciousness? Did you feel that, or was it something hazy and you just felt like this was a shelter you wanted to go to and you would see about everything else?
I felt that firmly from when I was first exposed to ISKCON as a teenager. When there was a painting that Karnam had this painting, and it was like a pyramid. and it had like Krishna or Vishnu at the top, but in that pyramid was also Muhammad and Buddha and all other various demigods. And just the fact, you know, because coming from Catholicism, it's, you know, our way or eternal flame. And so I didn't feel that that was an accurate belief. And so the fact that they had Buddha and Muhammad in this, and it was showing that, you know, Lord is coming in many ways for many different kinds of people in their level. You know, we know you can't teach algebra to kindergartners. So he may come in some form and bring a less pure version of the message to help all these people here. And so, and the paintings. The first time I saw that picture of Lord Nrsimhadev, and also very, very high impact on me, was the picture of Mahavishnu sleeping. And all the universe is emitting from his pores. And to me, what that said was, is these ancient Indian people, they knew the Big Bang way before, thousands of years before Westerners did, because it was a cyclic expansion and contracting reality. You know, we it's multiple universes. And but, you know, to me, it was like, well, this culture, these ancient Vedas, this to me seems very legitimate, as opposed to the culture that I came from. It seemed much... I thought the Bible was like a good earth guide. It wasn't bad. But the Vedas are obviously like light years above and beyond. So much more in depth of just like, don't lie, steal. These are all like really basic and good things. But like Vedas, you know, as Srimad Bhagavatam, I mean, getting into like the fabric of material existence and its like creation and its real purpose for existing. And so even from a very young age, even though I was unable to practice, my first response to the Vaishnavas was, they said, oh, well, if you worship Lord Shiva, then you will, you know, be born as a female in Shiva Lok. And I would already knew enough to tell them. I said, we're all female to Krishna. And I said, I thought that you were supposed to be the devotee of the devotee. And so I was like already arguing with them to try to justify my, I was very strong, like Shiva attraction as teenager at that time, after being exposed. Of course, I tried to rationalize and justify as to why smoking pot was spiritual, and so that meant that I was into Lord Shiva, but quite convoluted and juvenile, but still was part of the evolution that ended up bringing me here.
So you went from extreme life of drugs to full time in the temple. You've been going very steadily for several years now. Do you have any desire to go back to living in the world? Of course, not a life of drugs, but living a, you know, your average American life in the world. Do you have any attraction to that?
So I'm biased. I definitely genuinely do not have any attraction for that, but I don't think I had attraction for that when I came here. I don't ever want to go and mix with the world and go to college or have some job. As long as the temple will accept my service and give me some meager facility to rest my bones, I don't want to go anywhere. I am more than content engaged in full-time service here. And my only real regret is I wish I would have just stayed with Nrsimha when I was 18 and just stuck with it. If I could go and tell myself that.
How is it that you have that? How do you have that kind of resolve? Why do you have that kind of resolve?
Well, I think it's kind of like when people who consume meat, they think it's like a discipline to not. They think it's like this thing you're like struggling with every day. Like I'm just resisting these steaks and, you know. So it's such a chore. It's the exact opposite is reality. Once you're a vegetarian and your taste changes, you know, this is like a non-food item. You know, it's not any kind of a discipline that's even being practiced. Now, that's not to say, obviously, it is a discipline here. You know, we have, and it's not always, you know, rainbows and sprinkles. Sometimes it's burning here. It's tapasya here is, you know, you have a false ego that constantly spews garbage into your brain. And luckily now I can kind of hopefully sift out the two and know the better one. Before it was just all one, in one sense, enjoying gobbling thing. But, you know, there is some discipline here, I think. But it's always more than worth it. You know, and all I have to do is think back to this wretched halfway house that they sent me to right when I left the rehab and just remember how broken and horrible my state was. It makes the frustrating times here easier. Also, when we think of the frustrating times as purificatory, for whatever reason, Krishna's trying to expand my tolerance right now. And through an unnamed person who works in the kitchen is giving me a hard time. But you know, this is all just Krishna's mercy. We have to just try to, I know I can say that, but there's definitely times when my mind is not always in agreeance. I don't know how I do it. I guess a lot of things actually help me from my substance abuse days. And a lot of things that they teach you in like the AA and NA, they say you don't have to be sober for the rest of your life. You just have to make it to bed tonight, just for today. So the same thing applies here. If I have a frustrating day here, all I got to do is stay calm and collected, do my service, and make it to my bed. I don't got to be here for the rest of my life, right? That's at least what I can kind of tell myself. Because one day at a time attitude is good. Many tools that I learned from those days. So I think Krishna sent me on a round and about road here to, I obviously had to work out some last bit of karma, but maybe to give me that experience so that I have some way to relate to some other fallen people.
But why, I mean, on the positive side, why do you say, do you feel that this is real life, that you're doing something meaningful as opposed to anything else you could do?
Oh, it's definitely the most important thing that you could be doing with your body and mind. With a little bit of faith and some understanding, you know, we can see that we don't want to be in samskara anymore. You know, we don't want to, we're done with the acquiring, controlling, and consuming for the most part. We want to be done. And I think that being, pursuing a spiritual path of life, especially this path here, as far as mundane changes for my body and mind is incredible. But beyond that, you know, is not taking birth anymore is really what it's all about. And I genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, feel that this is probably the only way to break the vicious cycle of samskar.
What inspires you more than anything else in your practicing life?
Why, I guess I am somewhat of a malecha, so comfort. But maybe not so many material ones, because devotional life isn't always stable. But really what's driving me is honestly just kind of being done with just material grind. I guess I'm selfish in that way. I'm not motivated by preaching and sharing. I'm really selfish, and I just myself want to kind of be done. But not in the Buddhist reject all material way. I want to use our body. But then again, we hear in the songs too, if the Lord wants us to take birth, if he'll give us some service, then we'll gladly accept that also. So it's not all about just, oh, get rid of this body and, you know, ascend to a, you know, state of no matter. But if the Lord wants us as birth as ant or anything, then that's fine too.
Can you say something about your feelings for Gurudev Srila Bhakti Sundar Govinda Dev Goswami Maharaj? Do you feel you have a relationship with him?
I definitely feel that way. I mean, so many, you know, videos. I mean, Chinmoy Dev is doing these wonderful movies now weekly, and he spends all this time subtitling them and everything. Not just those, many talks. When I first came, Srilika Didi is always playing some audio in the temple in Salt Lake, and through his devotees, every appearance and disappearance, all the devotees are sharing their heartfelt feelings. And although I've never physically met him, all the devotees here in SoCal consider this to be his ashram. And so if I'm doing any service here, then I will have some connection there. And I do feel some heartfelt connection of his mood and teachings.
Do you have some message for the lost souls wandering in this world or for your fellow practitioners? Something you want to share with the world?
I do have a message to the lost souls and anyone who is out there if they're in pain. And that's what it is. It's pain. There's no reason why people you know, even if it's not so gross and horrible like substance abuse, it could be jewelry and car and addiction of all those other forms. There's no reason to do these things other than pain and emptiness. And another thing that I really remember from NA and AA is they said everybody has a God-shaped hole in their chest. And you try to throw cigarettes and cars and women and clothes and jewelry and house and whatever else into it. Maybe it satisfies some little corner of that hole, but nothing will satiate it. And so if you're there and you hear me and you hear this and you think that there's nothing waiting for you tomorrow other than maybe you'll OD and wake up in the hospital, I know that can be a good day for some people. And if you're that low, just know that with some little bit of faith and effort, your whole reality can be taken, washed, turned upside down, and turned into a beautiful existence with a little bit of faith and hard work. And it's not hopeless. Chant the name of Krishna. Be happy. Do service. You are worth something.
That was beautiful. Very beautiful. Very inspiring. I want to ask you another question. Can you share some of the things that you've learned while living in ashram life from Srila Janardamurti, from the other Vaishnavas?
The first thing that really stands out is the reason why you come to live at the temple. And the reason why you come to live at the temple has absolutely nothing to do with the reason why you stay. Because when we come to spiritual life, especially for me anyway, and I've talked with others about this, we approach spiritual life like we approach a 7-Eleven. We've got a handful of money, which is our actions, and we view the spiritual entity or community or whatever it is we're approaching as, you know, they're going to provide us with a means of being happy. So at this store, I'm going to provide my prayer, my tapas, my whatever puja or whatever they want me to do, because they're all happy and I'm not. And so whatever they're doing is obviously a recipe for happiness. And so the main thing, a big thing that I learned that really helped me, is the reason we come to spiritual life is not the reasons we stay. We come because we're dissatisfied and we're in pain. And relief of that pain is not the goal of spiritual life. It is, however, most likely a side effect. And once you're engaged and you have some purpose, lack of purpose is crushing. You don't have anything, you're bored. Why not just waste yourself if you don't have any purpose? Because if you're not completely wasted and you don't have a purpose, it's totally depressing. Just to look at the world is horrible. And so I'm lost.
What is the reason that you stay?
The reason I stay is because that, you know, happiness does come, but it's not the goal. You know, you realize that there's such a higher goal, and our goal is to be a giving and serving unit, to provide a better experience for the, you know, Vaishnavas around us, especially if you reside in temple. That's kind of your main goal, is when the grihasthas come and they only have, you know, their one day a week that they can get away from their screaming baby, demanding wife and job and everything else, and come here, or husband, or as you like, you know, so we have to have a clean and nice temple for them to come to so that they can have that relief from their life. And so the purpose is not our happiness. And why do I stay? Is because I am happy. But it's not the goal. And that little bit of consciousness of knowing that your goal is to serve and your happiness comes second doesn't always, it's not a nice pill to swallow, but many medicines are bitter and they have very much benefit. So that's why I stay. I'm more satiated than ever before, because if I wasn't, I would have definitely been back to drugs and alcohol and everything else. Because as I said another night, where my parents failed, where the counselors and the teachers and the, you know, police officers failed, and where I even failed myself, because I was powerless, Krishna consciousness was the only thing with the potency to pull me from that muck. And so now I owe it my life. I wouldn't have a life without it. I have to give everything.
Well, that was a really inspiring story, your Dai Govinda Prabhu. Really, really, really very inspirational. Astonishing story, actually. And I'm sure many persons will find great hope hearing this. So I think we'll stop there and our gratitude to you for so openly, you know, sharing all of this.
Of course, of course. Dandavat pranams to all and listeners out there, and keep smiling.